atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy.
I'm political scientist Kimberly Weir. My guest is Martin Daunton, Professor Emeritus of Economic History at the University of Cambridge. Professor Daunton is a former president of the Royal Historical Society and author of The Economic Government of the World, 1933-2023. Martin Daunton, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
I was really fascinated by reading your book. It's a commitment, but it's a well worth the commitment. And you even say in your book that this was a project that was in the making for some time. And so to get started, I really was fascinated with why you started with the year 1933 and what is significant about what happened this year.
Yeah, I think 1933 I chose because when I started writing the book a long time ago, as you hinted, there was the global financial crisis. And in 2009, Gordon Brown, then the British Prime Minister, hosted a meeting of the G20 in London. And he said, this is the first major economic conference that's been held in London since the World Monetary and Economic Conference of 1933. The 1933 conference was a complete failure. And Gordon Brown said he hoped that 2009 would be a success. So I thought 1933 would be a really good sort of juxtaposition. 1933, failure. 2009, perhaps success. 1933, of course, also for the United States, Roosevelt had just entered the White House. And in Berlin, Hitler had just become Chancellor. And I thought 1933 would be therefore a really good moment to take because I could look back to the Versailles Peace Conference and what had happened since the First World War, providing a background to the failure of 1933, and looking forward to perhaps the success of the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944. So I had thought initially 1944 would be the start. I thought, no, you can't understand 1944 unless you understand what had gone wrong before. So that was the rationale for taking 1933.
Yeah, and it wasn't just some marketing ploy because it well rounded out with ending in 2023 because, as you say in your book, you actually had finished more or less your book by 2020 and then all of this stuff happened. So what encouraged you to like push ahead and spend three more years writing?
Well, partly my publisher said that he thought it would be good to come forward in time. And I agreed with him. I've always been interested in the relationship between history and policy. In Cambridge, we have a Centre for History and Policy. So myself and colleagues are really interested about that. And I thought also that people were using history for current political purposes. I thought that trying to understand the background after COVID to how to respond to a crisis would be a really useful thing to do. My great shame was that Jake Sullivan's speech after the Inflation Reduction Act, and where he talked about how America could again provide leadership, came up just after I finished the book. But that's really what I was thinking about. Had these international agencies, which I had set up in the beginning of my book, did they have any future? I think in 2023, after the pandemic and with the huge issues about climate change, that was a critical issue. So, yeah, looking back, but also in order to look forward to our current state.
Yeah. One of the main concerns you raise in your book is the shift away from the sort of country cooperation that happened toward the end of World War II that created the global institutions like the IMF and the United Nations. What were you say were the biggest contributing factors to this shift that you seem to think are quite important toward multilateralism that's lacking today?
Yeah, so I think the point I'm making in the book is that to understand the apparent success of setting up the International Monetary Fund, the International Bank of Reconstruction Development, and after that, GATT, can't be understood except in particular contingencies of the first of the Second World War. And I wanted to understand what those contingencies were, because again, that was a way in which people misuse history. There was a lot of talk after the global financial crisis, let's get back to Bretton Woods, as if that was something which was possible, which it wasn't, because of completely different circumstances. And of course, it's easy to reform the world monetary system when the world monetary system is closed down, as it was in 1944, and when there were only two major countries, Britain and the United States, to sort it out. So I think that was the was one of those circumstances in which it was possible to create these international agencies. And also, of course, because you're responding to the obvious failures in the 1930s, the failures after that conference in 1933, beggar my neighbor policies adopted by Germany, Britain, the United States, amongst others. So it's a consciousness that you really had to take action. It seems if it had led to the World War. So I think that's the circumstances in which it happens. But it's also, of course, possible to do it, have successful conferences, because there's a small number of countries involved. So you start off with currency, technical issue, only Britain and the United States. You only let other countries in later when you've already fixed the agenda. Of course, that is a fantasy to think that can happen again. So I think one of the points I want to get at is it's only in particular circumstances that you can create those global institutions. And those global institutions exclude a lot of people. So one of the themes in the book, I think, is the way in which this is interconnected with decolonization. You're dealing with imperial powers coming together, creating institutions, which some historians, like Malcolm Zoa, who's written the history of the United Nations, see in a way as maintaining the rule of the former of empires. So not former empires at this point. They would become former empires. There's the tension to continue them.
And as you mentioned, with so many countries in the world today and not having those very clear-cut leaders, right? We see a lot of tension just in the no longer bipolar system that we have. It makes for a much different world and landscape than try to effect any sort of changes.
Absolutely. So we were dealing, I suppose, in 1944 at Bretton Woods with what could be called G2, or perhaps I would say G1.5. The one being the United States and a half, if you're lucky, being Britain. Other countries were trying to push to have a voice there, but I think the British and the American delegates kept them out. That's not feasible any longer. So we're dealing there with perhaps a bilateral system. And the voting rights of the IMF were skewed towards those two countries. They're still skewed.
Bill, yeah.
Not as much as it was then, but it is still skewed. If we're going to have success in a more plurilateral world, which we have now, then these institutions need fundamental reform, if indeed they are reformable.
You organize your book around processes, procedures, and distributive justice concerns. And I think especially the last one oftentimes gets left out. And so I thought that was a really important component of your book. Why do you argue that these are the most important considerations for global economic policy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think about how to structure a book over a long period of time. One has to have some sort of leitmotif or theme running through it. It's a very long book. I think trying to provide some structure is very important. And I suppose one theme I wanted to pick up was that we can't look at monetary policy in isolation. Many scholars in international relations look at monetary policy, or they look at trade policy, but they don't look at the two together. So what I wanted to look at is the trade-off between different issues. So do you have fixed exchange rates, float exchange rates? How does that interconnect with capital mobility or capital controls? How does that interconnect with free trade or protectionism? So I'm trying to look at the way in which those issues interrelate. And that then takes me to another theme, which is that the relationship between those is linked to domestic policy. So at what point and what circumstances will the domestic electorate accept internationalism? At what point will they reject internationalism for economic nationalism? So I think that looking at the whole period, that's the process. So 1930s, obviously economic nationalism bumps internationalism. Could say that after the 1970s, internationalism trumps nationalism. Both are dangerous. And I think what I was trying to get at is that the period after the Second World War was a moment at which it was possible to balance the pursuit of domestic welfare and internationalism without going too far towards rejecting domestic welfare for pursuit of internationalism, which I think happened in that era of hyper-globalization at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century. So I thought those were the themes to play with within the book. I hope it came off in that way. I suppose another issue which is very much in my mind as we were moving towards the end of the book and dealing with current issues is the growing inequality we face domestically within the United States, within Britain. I think one argument that I try to put forward in the book is that distributive justice is both within countries and between countries. So I think that the international institutions at the end of the Second World War only worked because there was a degree of compromise, if you will, between capital and labor, that there was a modest level of profit for capital, reasonable wages for labor. There was a sort of social compact between the two, which then fractures at the current moment with growing inequality. So I think that we need to understand how a domestic social contract is necessary to stop the populism that we see around us at the moment. But then, of course, also distributive justice is about the world as a whole. As I said a moment ago, the Bretton Woods Agreement is being set up at the time of the British Empire, but about to give independence to India. So you have the voice coming from India, from Nehru, from Gandhi, arguing about we need to have a juster world. And I think one of the themes in the book is how that demand keeps coming forward. There was an attempt for it to come forward at Bretton Woods, which is rather limited, excluded. Then it comes back again in UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, then in the new international economic order. So I think one of the themes there is how you have the demands coming from the third world, the global south, and how they're being contained by the global north. And that, of course, is a big theme that we face today as well. So those are the themes, the processes, procedures I was trying to look at.
There are so many questions I want to ask you. Where to begin? So I guess the next thing I'll follow up on as part of what you were responding to is the 2024 elections in the United States are certainly on a lot of people's minds. What would you argue are the main challenges for multilateralism, the sort of thing you were just talking about, right? Having to respond to the domestic populace, but also understanding in trying to attempt to deal with climate change, especially, right, as the most prominent issue, global issue that we have to deal with. How, in doing that, do you deal with the rise of populist governments and autocratic governments and protectionist policies while really we need so much to have the multilateralism that we saw after World War II?
Well, this is the fundamental problem. Gosh, if I knew the answer to that, I think I would be president of the United States if I had an American citizenship or trying to become Prime Minister of Britain. It's really, really difficult issue. I went to a lecture last week by Pascal Lamy, the former head of the World Trade Organization, and he started off with a phrase which I wrote down somewhere. It said, "Never in my life have we been in such a mess."
That's saying a lot for Pascal Lamy.
And he then tried to provide a solution, which he admitted he didn't have. So, okay, so Pascal Lamy can't solve it. Hey, who am I? But here goes. One thing which Lamy said in his lecture was there is populism. He didn't really address that as an issue. And I think that's what I was hinting at a moment ago, how to deal with populism, I think requires action to address the issues about inequality that I was talking about. I went to another lecture last week. I seem to spend most of my time going to lectures by Polly Toynbee, who's a leading British journalist. And in 1970, she said she took time out from being a journalist to go and work in social care, in supermarkets, in a bakery, and so on, to write about the experience of life in Britain at that time. She did it again after COVID, and she had her pay slips. And she took the pay slips to the Institute for Fiscal Studies in London, which is a major non-partisan think tank, and said to them, how much in real terms has my salary as a social care worker gone down? 30%. And I think that's the fundamental issue, which I think is leading to protectionism, populism, economic nationalism, a sense of precariousness, precarity. And some of that is linked to deindustrialization, which I think is a major theme both in the United States and in Britain since the 1970s. Decline of secure jobs without formal skills, where you learn on the job, but you have a decent wage, a pension, security. Those people voted Brexit in this country. They voted for President Trump in your country. They have genuine grievances, but they've gone for, I think, the wrong solution. I think what is needed is a solution which deals with that precarity. I'm very struck by a recent report by UNCTAD, what I mentioned earlier, which refers to crocodile capitalism. And by crocodile capitalism, they mean a widening of the jaw, like a crocodile, between profits going up as a share of GDP and labor income going down. And I think that's, to my mind, the fundamental issue. And if we're going to go back to having multilateral institutions, possibly, we can, as I say, contingencies are different, then we have to have a sense of legitimacy, fairness, and distributive justice at home. And that can't be done unless you address this fundamental issue, I think, of growing inequality and precarity. Now, that's a big issue. I think it requires progressive politicians who have, how can I put it, confidence about the argument. And that sadly, in the United Kingdom, I see caution by the progressive left, or centre-left of the Labour Party, and possibly a little bit more confidence from Biden. But I think President Biden has his own political problems. So how to articulate those sorts of visions within our two societies, I think, is a fundamental issue before we can start thinking about the multilateral institutions.
And in fact, one of the statistics that you give in your book reflects what you were explaining the journalist found from her experience, which was that 28% of Americans' children find themselves worse off than their parents had. So I think the statistics was from 1945 to 1973. People were much better off by like a marginal percent. And then subsequent to 1973, it's like now they're 28% worse off than what their parents were.
Yeah, I think this is a real fundamental turnaround. And that striking statistic you just quoted has led me to start writing another book, which is going to be shorter, not take me 20 years, but because by then I'll be dead. Would about this if like this intergenerational issue. So I'm very conscious, being of a certain age, that I retired with a very generous pension. I bought my first house at the age of 25. The average age of buying a first house now in the United Kingdom is about 35 or 36. Mortgage costs are much higher. The multiple of the salary to buy a house is much higher. So you can't buy a house and save a decent pension. Student debt is higher. Post-war generation in Britain didn't have to pay for tuition. So I think there's a really fundamental issue here that people have a right to feel disillusioned and marginalized and to have lost out. And at the same time, of course, people of my generation who had savings as a result of quantitative easing after COVID, after the global financial crisis, our capital income has continued to go up. So I think there's a growing inequality, not only within generations, but between generations. I think it's important to have put those two together. It's not one either or, it's both. And I think that's going to become worse because those people have got the wealth and the baby boom generation will give it to their children if they have those assets and if they've gained. And it's going to lead to growing inequality with the children of parents who don't have those assets and parts of. So I think that really needs to be resolved. I think that then comes down to international issues, because I think I follow the line in the book of Klein and Pettis's book, Trade Wars or Class Wars. So if you've got this inequality within the United States of America, in order for people who are suffering the way you said, with their income levels going down, compared with previous generations, they have to borrow. You have debt. You have the subprime mortgage crisis back in 2007, 2008. The United States is able to run up debt because it can print dollars. So you have the indebtedness of the United States, but of course then China has a massive savings rate. It has one of the highest savings rates in the world. So that's holding down domestic consumption. So they then need the United States debt in order to buy those goods. So I think you have, in order to have multilateral agreements, you have to have a resolution, not only of the distributive issues within the United States I was talking about, but also within China. You can't really think about having global cooperation until you start solving that fundamental structural problem.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important point that some people wonder why it is that if it's so important that countries get together to do things, why don't they just do it? But you just laid out for us why it is that countries can't get together and work together, because they have those domestic constraints. And I think that what's really interesting too, about especially the example you just gave with U.S., indebtedness and China having so much excess, and then China ends up buying U.S. bonds and notes, right? That to me, always at the time that was happening, I kept thinking, well, China has no incentive to provoke the United States. Like, you know, China and the United States aren't going to go to war with each other. They're so super interdependent. They have the symbiotic relationship. Well, now though, we see on almost a daily basis, China's increasing role in politics in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and just sort of aggravating the United States and also all of those Southeast Asian neighbors. So what sort of impact do you think this has on China's economic future and its relations, and maybe as a global economic leader?
Yeah, that's a really big, big question.
Sorry. I'm a really big contextual person, which is why I liked your book so much.
I think going back in history, I'm always very struck by the way in which people like Cordell Hull in the United States, who is such an important figure in my book, because he was the person who was advocating for free trade and cooperation, he thought that if people trade together, they can't go to war. Well, of course, that's just not true, because Germany and Britain before the First World War traded with each other and were highly mutually dependent, and they went to war. So we can't assume that, you know, there was going to be peace because of trade. So what's going on now, I think, is really quite intriguing and dangerous, because I'm very pessimistic about China, about the Chinese economy, and had been for some considerable time, because that very high savings rate I referred to means that you have to do something with it. One thing is to buy American treasury bonds. There have been always had the balance of financial terrorism, like if you don't behave, you'll sell your bonds and so on. So there was that. And it's also pumping money into the property boom in China itself, building more and more infrastructure, which had perhaps marginal return. We've seen the collapse of Evergrande, the big property company. Chinese local government is dependent upon the property boom in order to sustain its finances. If that collapses, what's going to happen there? So I think the financial system, property system in China is very fragile. Then you've got the Belt and Road Initiative, of money being pumped out into the rest of the world, not very transparent. You also have the debt from the IMF and other Western banks. They're in the Paris Club to resolve that, but China is not. So what's going to happen there? And very often there's collateral, like the port in Sri Lanka or various assets in Pakistan. There's a sort of neo-colonialism there, possibly an emerging debt crisis in those countries. I think that the level of emerging market debt is very high. So I think a problem in China could lead to a problem elsewhere in the world as well. I think that's very dangerous. Does that mean that one thing the Chinese government might contemplate is some sort of, if like external threat to deal with internal disruption?
Oh, we've not seen that any time recently, have we?
I don't know what I'm seeing.
I mean, you know, there's no way that a leader of a country would invade another country just to take the focus off of what's going on at home with domestic problems. Would we see that?
Yeah. On the other hand, let's try and be optimistic. It might not happen, but I wouldn't bank on it. So I think this is one of the issues about multilateral cooperation. How to deal with this? It's really, really very, very problematic. Does one deal with it by trying to engage? China's in the World Trade Organization.
Mm-hmm. That was the point of bringing them in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah, and look how well that worked. Well, I think that's a really big issue about how to handle this engagement or not. I suppose the optimistic line would be to say that the attempt by the Chinese to create this new BRICS bloc is not going to work, because is how much common interest is there really within that group? China and Russia might come together for various strategic reasons, but I think that is the Russian economy about the same size as Italy? It's not massive. It's not going to provide the market for all the Chinese goods. So one might wonder if that's going to happen. Some countries like Brazil or South Africa, of course, will want to exploit being members of BRICS in order to try and bargain with the European Union and the United States. So I think one has to accept there's going to be an awful lot of manoeuvring tensions around this. I think what one needs then is to have clever politicians within the United States and Britain and the European Union. Now, I have never been accused of being Henry Kissinger, but Adam Tooze Harold James at Princeton, in a review of my book, in a British journal, said that I was advocating Henry Kissinger. That Henry Kissinger, at the time of the oil crisis in the 1970s, went in for policy, what he called fuzz it up, which was to say, don't take it like a principled stand and say, we're not going to listen to OPEC. We're not going to listen to the third world countries. We're not going to take them on head on, but we will try and divide and rule. So we'll pick off one country at another. Now, okay, so Henry Kissinger is a somewhat cynical player in realpolitik. But you can see why Harold James was saying, was making that point. Don't go for an all-out confrontation with China, but try and pick off those people who might be allying with China. Perhaps it's cynical. Adam Tooze said that my book is disillusioned. In other words, it doesn't have illusions about what is going to be feasible. It doesn't have a belief that you can recreate that post-war world order, because that only can happen in certain circumstances. What you have to have is some sort of idea that we need to try and mitigate tension by, if I ad hocery. Now, I don't know if that's possible. That depends upon having clever politicians who are able to maneuver around all of these tensions in the world. I don't think the solution is to hold out the idea that you're going to suddenly recreate some sort of global governance by simply re-establishing the IMF, World Trade Organization, in some world which actually never existed.
That's actually a question I wanted to ask you about, because it seems like countries like, especially Argentina, are always making headlines for their disastrous economic situation. What, third, fourth bailout for Argentina at this point? Economic turmoil nonstop. The peso is just atrocious. And so any number of developing countries regularly rely on these institutions that you're talking about, right? The IMF and the World Bank. Do you think, I mean, it sounds like from what you just said, you don't really seem optimistic that they're of any use beyond perpetuating the current global economic divide between richer and poorer countries?
I think they can be of some modest use. I think they can be useful, you know, policing boundaries between blocks. Okay, that's one point. So if one says, well, look, the BRICS would emerge, or the European Union, or Mercosur, or whatever it might be. The danger is that they can become inward-looking protectionist blocs, like happened in the 1930s with Schäftenism, named after the German economic minister, inward-looking. One wants to try and make sure that that doesn't happen. I think it might be that bloc will emerge, and that they can be, I mean, European Union is a bloc, which has led to some sort of economic welfare within economic growth within Europe's stability so far. But one doesn't want that to become a closed bloc in the same way you don't want to have a closed bloc around China or the United States. But if I'm bringing resources back home, breaking down supply chains, you don't want that to collapse. So I think what the World Trade Organization do is could police those boundaries. And going back to your question earlier on about climate change, I think if one is saying that some countries might be in pursuit of net zero more successfully than others, you could have carbon border taxes in order to force other countries to adapt. So if they don't go for net zero, you tax the carbon content of the imports into another country. I think the IMF has shown some action over policing things like tax rates, perhaps working there with the OECD. So I think particularly when Christine Lagarde was there, there was an attempt by the IMF to try and move the issues forward from their earlier pursuit of a market liberal agenda, financialization, and pursuit of completely open markets. I think that they were trying to move more on those issues of equalizing the playing field over taxation, so you don't just have tax havens and base shift, profit erosion, base shifting, and so on. So I think that's useful. I think also the World Trade Organization, the IMF, can provide technical guidance. Sometimes they are actually a valuable input. So sitting here in Britain at the moment, we have a budget coming up in March where it is thought that the Chancellor of the Exchequer will cut taxes. Now, that could, of course, possibly, who knows, be related to the fact there's going to be a general election soon. And he might think, I don't know why, that in a situation where he's about 20% behind in the opinion polls, giving people tax break, particularly by abolishing inheritance tax, might lead to a bigger success for his party than otherwise might be the case. Well, the IMF came in and said, I don't think this is a good idea, that the first priority should be to reduce the national debt rather than giving tax breaks. And also, it would be much more important to maintain a good quality of public services. So one didn't imagine, I think, looking back at 1976, when we had an IMF crisis, when the IMF came in and forced the Labour Party to balance the books, didn't think the IMF would actually be more radical than the Labour Party, saying things which the leader of the Labour Party is perhaps unwilling to say because he thinks it might make voters think that he is a tax and spend government. So I think that the IMF can be helpful in providing disinterested advice in certain circumstances. I'm not going to go further than that, because I don't think the IMF has actually been as successful at any point of time since the Second World War as they might like to think. They were set up to run the Bretton Woods Agreement, fixed exchange rates. When that started to fall apart, the IMF didn't come in to restore it. That was done through all sorts of other bodies like the OECD or various G groupings. And then their intervention in Russia, in Korea, in the 70s, 80s, 90s was not necessarily successful. I think they went down a particular line, too rigid. I think perhaps they've learned the lesson of those mistakes now. But I don't think at the global financial crisis they were so successful. You could say that the body which has been most successful, surprisingly, has been the Bank of International Settlements, which is a group of central bankers working together to prevent the financial system falling apart. And that's ironic, because at Bretton Woods in 1944, it was agreed that the Bank of International Settlements should be abolished, because central bankers were dangerous. It now looks almost as if central bankers are the only international group which can work together. That was a point that Pascal Lamy made. He sort of puzzled and said, well, why is it that the World Trade Organization fails after Doha, whereas the Bank of International Settlements has worked together?
I'd like to take an entirely different turn, because I've always been interested in food politics and the global economy. And so one thing that I think is really interesting that most people probably don't know is that the first big international conference at the end of World War II was not to discuss economic policy, but to discuss food policy. Why was this such a priority? And this very much connects with everything that you had just been saying about how the world is going now and indebted countries and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Like one thing I wanted to pull out in the book, that we need to move away from this obsession with Bretton Woods and monetary and financial issues. So as you say, the first international conference during the war was at Hot Springs in Virginia. And it was on food and agriculture. it really puzzled John Maynard Keynes, who made some sarcastic remark about why does the president think that the first thing to do in order to resolve the problems of the world is to have a meeting about food and agriculture. He just completely failed to understand why Roosevelt was doing it. I think that indicates the limits of John Maynard Keynes' vision of the world. It comes out of a number of approaches, I think. One is work being done within the whole area of colonial economic development. So you have a concern by the British government and by agencies within India to say that what is holding back Africa, what is holding back India? Food, nutrition. So they developed the idea about nutrition and vitamins. So you have a big research institute in Pune. It was picked up by Nehru and Gandhi. It was run by the British government, but it feeds into Indian nationalism. We need to provide decent quality of food. So that's one element. That also feeds into British domestic politics. John Boyd Orr, who was one of the great figures within food, and he was first head of the Food Agricultural Organization, Scots. He advocated free milk to school children. He advocated in the 1930s better quality of welfare and of nutrition for British workers, which he was denounced by the then government for saying that the level of social payments for unemployed people did not allow them to maintain a decent quality of health. So he's linking domestic health with economic development. In the United States, Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace, food stamps, was a very important figure in that meeting. So Orr and Wallace, but then the Australians, and I think the role of Australia is really fascinating in this. Two Australians were instrumental at the League of Nations in the 1930s. So the World Monetary and Economic Conference, 1933, which is a League of Nations organized event, it fails. There had been an attempt there by some of the people at the League of Nations to create a new gold standard. That fails. And what the Australians within the League were arguing for is what they call positive security. And they have a vested interest in this because Australia is an exporter of wool, of wheat and other primary products. Prices have collapsed in the interwar period, led to depression. And of course, the same thing for Argentina, for Canada, for American farmers. And they say that the best way to restore the world economy is by having Europe grow fruit and vegetables and dairy products close to the market. That will improve people's quality of nutrition. And then rather than protecting wheat farmers within Europe, import those bulk commodities from Australia, from Canada, from Argentina. Everybody will be better off. There'll be markets for both primary producers and manufacturers. There will be better quality of life. And they argue that that is what's necessary. What is necessary is the full employment of the resources of the world. So that's the vision of positive security, which is being put forward by the primary producing nations. And I think that's actually a really important vision, which continues to feed through into the 1950s and 1960s. Different guises, but I think that's there all the time. So I'm trying to pull that theme out within the book. But I think there's also, if I could add another conference which takes place between the food and agriculture conference and Bretton Woods, it's the meeting in Philadelphia of the International Labour Organization. And that meeting is again about creating full employment. And the argument, again, the Australians put forward is, if we're going to give up the right to devalue our currencies, in response to external circumstances, which is what Bretton Woods would do. It would peg exchange rates. We've got to be certain that our output of our food, of agricultural commodities, will be bought by the rest of the world. And we can't have do that unless you have full employment of the resources of the world. And that means that the United States of America, which they saw as an intrinsically unstable economy, subject to boom and bust, must adopt full employment policies. So I think what's going on here is a really interesting interplay of different ideas. Those voices are marginalized at Bretton Woods, but they're put forward at Hot Springs and Philadelphia, and then they come up again after the war at the International Trade Organization conference in Geneva and then Havana. So I think those outside voices are, I think, an important part of the whole story.
Yeah, we see the push for better nutrition leads to the demand for food, which leads to increased farmer prosperity, which leads to demand for industrial goods, which leads to overall economic development.
Yeah. Sounds good.
So we see policymakers have been aware of this need for stable prices for these primary goods producers since the 1930s. But this still remains an issue, especially when we start looking at developing countries around the world. So where does that leave us?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question about how the demand I've just been setting out is sort of pushed back. OPEC in 1973, it was considered by a lot of these prime producers to be the beginning of the rebalancing of the world economy, about terms of trade, essentially, between primary producers and industrial producers. And that's what happens at UNCTAD with Raul Prebisch, the Argentinian economist, who thought that the whole problem was the global north charging more for its goods, its manufactured goods, and the prime producers getting less. Well, yes, that's arguably correct, but we see at the end of the Second World War, the Food and Agricultural Organization being scuppered, as John Boyd also saw, by the selfish men crawling out of their bunkers during the war. They come back. If you were the British government and you are facing austerity after the war, the last thing you're going to want is to have food prices going up. And this was said explicitly by one of the British government advisors, Herbert Henderson, who had worked with Keynes in Cambridge in the 1930s. Herbert Henderson said, why did Britain recover from the Depression? It wasn't because of Keynes policies. It's because food prices dropped. And food prices dropped meant that British workers had more money to spend on manufacturing commodities, and that led to recovery. So Henderson is saying, well, no, actually, we don't want to stabilize prices. It's a rather, how can I put it, a callous view, which is not about distributive justice, it's about exploitation. So I think there's a problem for British politicians thinking, what would be the electoral consequences of having higher prices for food imports, energy imports? It comes back to domestic politics.
Yeah, again, we see that disconnect between what needs to happen internationally and what's going on at home and those constraints.
Yeah, and you referred to stable prices. Well, you see, that again becomes an issue. Keynes said they happy to have stable prices, but that's not what the Global South wanted. Global South wanted rising prices compared with manufactured commodities. And he said, no, I'm not going to accept that. What Keynes believed would happen would be, if you had stable prices, you would have a gradual move towards the most efficient producers, least efficient producers would, you know, stop producing it all. You know, that, so it would be a gradual stability and was most efficient. Well, that's not what the Third World or Global South wanted. They wanted to have rising prices. So I think that, you know, trying to resolve this is an interesting question when I talk about the fair trade movement. I think fair trade probably means something different in Britain than what it means in America.
No, I wouldn't say so. Fair trade movement being the giving the producers a livable wage that's a reasonable, yeah,
because sometimes fair trade can mean more about not having protections and what. Yeah, so I think that's an interesting movement in this country, in the United States, having sort of fair trade movement, which certainly lots of young people are concerned about. I don't know about your universities, but my university, I have to say that every commodity is produced on fair trade terms. I think one thing that, going back to your question about multilateral organisations, I think the two bodies at the end of the Second World War, which are weak and ought to be encouraged, are the Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Health Organization. Both of those are starting out within the League of Nations in the 1930s. They're poorly funded. So I think I say in the book that the funding of the World Health Organization is about equivalent to a major city hospital, and that's for the whole world. And it's been partly dependent upon Chinese money. So I think that one of the issues about the COVID crisis, you know, they have to be really careful of how they turn on. So I think in the future, with climate change leading to potential for more zoonotic diseases, and this issue about the environment and how population growth and economic growth is impinging upon the natural world, I think that's where these two organizations need to have more funding and more status than they currently have.
Yeah, I think that maybe as a way to wrap up everything you've talked about, and since climate change is such an important issue, that how is resolving countries' debt necessarily tied to tackling climate change?
Oh, well, I mean, that's something which is very much in the air within the United Kingdom in the last week or so, where the Labour opposition was claiming it would spend £28 billion a year on a green transition. And it's now said it won't, because it considers the balance in the books to be more important. I think this is wrong, as to a lot of people across the political spectrum, actually. And some conservative politicians have been very active indeed about spending more. So I think that we have to be really careful about not saying that a growing level of national debt, so the GDP per capita, GDP to debt ratio in Britain is about 100%. I don't think we should be hung up on that so much. I think the question is, what is the return on the investment going to be? That's how a business would deal with it. So I think that's important. I think that GDP in itself is a very dangerous concept. I think we should be going more for the sort of argument which economists like Parthadas Gupta and Dieter Helmer are putting forward, which is you should measure natural capital. GDP can actually lead to an erosion of natural capital, so that we're leaving less for the future generations, to go back to our earlier point about generational justice. So I think that spending more on the green transition is very important, and more important than being hung up about a level of debt to GDP, which is actually a false measurement.
Much more along the lines of what the World Bank has actually been pushing for, with recognizing the role of natural capital that it can play.
Absolutely. I think that's one thing which is really interesting. There's a recent report by the IMF which said that we should not be measuring debt to GDP we should be looking at assets. What assets does a country have? And I think that, if we're looking at it from the point of view of Britain, austerity has led to a running down of assets. But if you were doing that in the private sector, you go bankrupt. Allowing the whole capital stock of the country to depreciate. That's not a wise way of proceeding. So they've been advocating producing a sort of like a balance sheet. Our GDP is flow, not stock. So I think we need to have a revolution in economics. And that's one thing which I think I hint at the end of the book. That in the 1930s, there was an intellectual revolution in economics. It was Keynesianism. In the 1970s, there was an economic revolution, which is more neoliberal revolution. But we didn't have an economic revolution, I think, in fundamental concepts after the global financial crisis. And it's about time that we did. My book had one criticism. I'm sure there are many other criticisms, but one criticism that was made by a professor of economic history from the University of Oxford is that I was not critical enough about economics in the book. Well, I thought I was trying pretty hard, but I think that we do need to have a new way of thinking about these issues, and I think that's where we need. If I said new Keynes, because I'm actually quite critical about Keynes in some respects, but we need to have a new way of thinking about natural capital, about a different measure of GDP, about what the purpose of economic growth is, if that's desirable.
Yeah, I'm the whole move there. I wish it was a much bigger movement than what it is, but degrowth and stability, right? The idea that we developed countries have grown enough. It's not about GDP growth. It's about quality of life and so forth. That's something that really we need, that paradigm shift.
Yeah. And there's also our distribution, which I was talking about. Mm-hmm. I think we do need a paradigm shift. And I hope that it comes.
Me too. Thank you so much, Martin, for taking the time to talk to me. There are so many more things I wish we would have had the time to talk about. Your book is full of so much more that's worth considering, like cryptocurrency is something that's obviously, we didn't get a chance to talk about that, or you foresee a future where the dollar's exorbitant privilege is reduced. And so I encourage people to get your book and take a look at what you actually have to say about these things and give it a read.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff, is what I am saying. And I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at politicsguys. You can also support the show through PayPal. And all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.